Somewhere in the USSR, there lives a young boy of 17 by the name of Volodenko. And Volodenko became famous 5 years ago when a Yiddish journalist returned from the Soviet Union and brought back his story and that of his grandfather. The Yiddish journalist was in the city of Kiev in the Ukraine. And on the Sabbath, he went to the one synagogue left in Kiev to see what Judaism and Jewry were in the Soviet Union in the Ukraine. And when he returns, he told of what happened on that Sabbath in Kiev. As he was sitting, from behind him, he heard the voice of a Jew with his tallis, his prayer shawl over his head, whispering to him in Yiddish. And the Jew said to him, "Reb Yid, don't turn around. I have something to tell you." And what he told him was the following. He told him that he had lost his entire family during the war, except for one son, who in turn had a son of his own, a young boy of 12 by the name of Volodenko. And until the age of 6, the grandfather would take Volodenko to synagogue every Shabbat. And then Volodenko began to go to school, and the teacher found out that he went to synagogue. And he made him stand before the class, and he shamed him. And from that moment on, Volodenko refused to go to synagogue. And now he was 12 years old. A bar mitzvah was coming. And the grandfather whispered how much he wanted his grandson to have a bar mitzvah. But he knew that it could not be. And so he told the journalist, "When you go back home, don't be quiet. Shake the world. Shake it so that my Volodenko will be a Jew." We did not shake the world. From 1917 to 1964, we did not even hold one street protest for Soviet Jewry in this country. 47 years of silence in the streets. I understand that it takes Jewish organizations time to make a decision. In general, when a resolution comes up, it's brought before a study committee, which studies it and studies it and studies it. It is then passed down to a subcommittee, and then to the committee. And it takes time to decide to do things. But 47 years is a little too much even for Jewish organizations. For 47 years we were silent, just as we were silent 30 years ago. Many of you in this room remember how in 1939 a ship sailed out of Hamburg, Germany. The ship was called the St. Louis, and on the ship were Jews, more than 900 Jews, who managed to get out of Hitler's Germany in time. They were among the last Jews to get out. And there was only one country in the entire world that was willing to take them in, and that was Cuba. So So they sailed for Cuba. And it was only when they arrived in Cuba that they realized that they were told that their entry visas were illegal. And they were told that they would have to go home. Home to Hitler. And there began a great drama. The Jews stayed on the ship, anchored 90 miles away from Miami Beach, where other Jews were enjoying freedom along Collins Avenue. And our Jewish leaders went to the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, for whom every Jew voted, for whom every Jew wept when he died, but for whom they will build no monuments in Israel. And they went to Franklin Roosevelt and they pleaded with him to jeopardize the safety of the Republic by allowing 900 Jews to come in over and above the quota. And Franklin Roosevelt, ever vigilant for the safety of the Republic, said it could not be done. There were laws here, there were quotas, and the German quota was filled. And the Jews pleaded with him to mortgage the quota to future years. Mortgage it to 1970. And the president said, I cannot bend the law. And so he didn't. And the president went home. Our Jewish leaders went home. And the Jews on the St. Louis went home. I know rabbis who were arrested in Selma, Alabama for civil rights. I don't know any rabbis who, when it was a question not of civil rights but of Jewish lives, decided to spotlight the tragedy of Jews by breaking the law in Washington, D.C. And 4 years later, when we Jews learn that there exists a place on this earth called Auschwitz, where every 24 hours, between sunrise and sunrise, 12,000 Jews are killed. And when we knew that this place existed, we again went to the president with a concrete plan to save these Jews. And our Jewish leaders went to him and they said, you can save hundreds of thousands of lives if you will only bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz. And they presented him with the maps given by the Czech underground, the maps of the death camp and of the rail lines and of the bridges. And the President of the United States, whose bombers bombed everything on this earth that moved, said that for technical reasons, it would be unable to bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz. And so the President went home. And our Jewish leaders went home. And 2.5 million Jews died in Auschwitz. Do we have any complaints to the Roosevelts of the world? If we are, we're fools. If a Jew still believes that the Roosevelts of the world will help Jews, if one believes this, he's a fool. We have no complaints to those people from whom we expect little or nothing. At whom should we direct our complaints? At those from whom we had a right to expect more. I know Jewish leaders who were freedom riders in Mississippi and who proudly and who eagerly and who gladly broke the law. The immoral law. I don't know of a single Jewish leader who chained himself to the White House gates or who called 100,000 Jews into the streets of Washington, D.C. to sit in the streets and not to move until the rail lines are bombed. I don't know of Jewish leaders who had the decency of black leaders who, when their people were denied civil rights and human rights, and when their problems were not gas chambers, but their problems were inequality of education and employment, went into the streets and defied the immoral law, and they won. I don't know any Jews or any Jewish leaders that did this when every day 12,000 Jews went to the gas chambers. And no Jewish leader and no Jewish organization can honestly and truthfully say our hands have not had a share in the shedding of that blood. We were silent then, and we were silent for all the decades of the persecution of Soviet Jewry. And suddenly, the silence of Jewish organizations was broken. Loud and raucous shouts, loud and raucous protests. At whom? Not so much at the Soviet Union, but at Jews, at militant Jews. Suddenly, when after 53 years of violence against Soviet Jewry, a bomb went off at the Aeroflot office in New York City, we beheld the spectacle of our Jewish leaders running to Washington and shouting, "It wasn't us, we're good Jews. We're white Jews. It was those lousy Jews, those militants. You can catch them. It's okay with our blessings." Suddenly the silence was broken. If a Jew cannot feel the pain of a second Jew, something within him is dead as a Jew. Because what is the essence of being Jewish if not Ahavat Yisrael, love of the Jewish people, and not the lip service which is so easily paid? It's not through sermons about loving Jews that one really practices love of Jews. It is through feeling the pain and not being able to sleep and not being able to eat and knowing that that is your pain. For 5 decades, the Soviet Jewish question was buried in the back pages of the newspapers where no one saw it and no one heard of it and no one cared and obviously no one would solve it. Today, the Soviet Jewish question has been taken off the back pages and put where it belongs, on page 1. And how was that done? Not by speeches, and not by sermons, and not by the charade which we used to see year after year, where our Jewish leaders would go to Washington and meet with the particular resident of the White House. It didn't matter whether it was a Democrat, a Republican, it was the same charade. And they would come back to us and tell us what they had done for Soviet Jewry. And they would tell us, the president gave us 45 minutes of his time. And that is indeed Yiddish Nachas. 45 minutes out of a busy day, once a year. And we would be overjoyed. But our Jewish leaders would tell us more. And they would tell us, the president told us that he sympathizes fully with the plight of Soviet Jewry. Our cup runneth over. Not only does the president sympathize, but fully. Is there any greater joy than this? Let us quit now while we're ahead. Let's not be pigs. Nevertheless, we in our overwhelming joy would ask, "Nu, nu," and then what else did he say? And then our leaders would tell us, and then he said, "But I'm sorry. But I'm sorry. I can't do anything." The Soviet Jewish question was put on page one, and Soviet Jews are getting out at this point at a rate far exceeding that at any time previously, not because of the speeches and not because of the 45-minute visits, but because American Jews decided within the past year to begin atoning for the sin of 30 years ago, to begin atoning for the sin of silence, and to do whatever has to be done to save 3.5 million Jews. And so Jews are appalled. What are you doing? There are Soviet buildings blown up. And I understand from the New York Times that Soviet automobiles were firebombed. And diplomats are pushed and harassed, and life is made intolerable for them. Is this any way for nice Jewish boys to be? And they say, "Be careful, you'll make things worse for the Jews over there." And what do they really mean? And what are they really saying? And what do they really fear? Be careful. What will they think about us here? And what will the non-Jew do to me? And how will this affect me and my status? And in 1943, when Roosevelt told Rabbi Stephen Wise, "Be careful. Don't make this a Jewish war. You'll create anti-Semitism," that is what suddenly sent fear and chills down the Jewish spine. And so Jews have this terrible, terrible need to be loved by the non-Jew. It's a product of their insecurities and their complexes of the galut of the exile in which they live. Two years ago, the State of Israel had an object lesson in the sympathy of the world, how one gains it and how one loses it. When they sent their commandos to Beirut Airport to make Havdalah over 13 Arab airplanes, and that night they lost the sympathy of the world. The UN condemned them 15 to nothing, and one doesn't get better than that. The Vatican attacked this, and the Jewish state lost the sympathy which it had so laboriously gained 1 week earlier at Athens Airport, when a Jew was killed. And indeed, that is the formula for those who are obsessed with the need for sympathy on the part of non-Jews. If you want sympathy, the formula is clear. One Jew is killed, you will get sympathy. And if two Jews, you will get more sympathy. And if, please God, we manage to hit 6 million, you will get sympathy, and you will get plaques, and you will get monuments, and the Chancellor of West Germany will kneel and weep at a monument. It's time for Jews to understand that before we can get love of the world, we must have respect and one doesn't gain respect by asking for it or by pleading for it. One gains respect by having self-respect. And by understanding that for too long have Jews marched for every cause in the whole world. If there is a cause, the Jew will march for it. So we march in Laos, in Angola, in Mozambique, Antarctica, you name it, and Jews will march for it. Time has come for a Jew to understand that by marching for these things, he will not gain sympathy and love. It's time for a Jew to understand that for a Jew, Jewish is beautiful. And for a Jew, it is the Jewish cause which comes first. Because in the end, when all is said and done, when the crisis arrives, no one will fight for the Jew. No one will help a Jew except another Jew. The late Prime Minister of Israel, Levi Eshkol, put it well. When following a condemnation of Israel by the UN, I forget which particular one that was. We tend to lose track of them after a while. Mr. Eshkol held a news conference in which he stated, "Gentlemen, you know, had we lost the war, the eulogies over the Jewish state would have been among the most beautiful of all time. All over the world, parliaments would have risen for 2 minutes of silence. Nebuch, 2.5 million more Jews gone." Instead, he said, the cabinet met in special session to consider the question, shall we live? And they voted yes. So we fought. They condemn us for it. We prefer it that way. And this is what the Jew must understand. Violence? How much violence? As much as is necessary for the Jew to survive. And when we say those words, our Jewish leaders, the secular leaders of Jewish organizations, cry out, this is un-Jewish. What you are saying is un-Jewish. The Jewish Defense League is un-Jewish. We hear this from those eminently Jewish organizations, the American Jewish Congress, B'nai B'rith, the committee, and what have you. Instant experts on what is Jewish. Leaders whose Jewish background was arrested somewhere at the age of 13. They inform us, they tell us what is Jewish. These people whose concepts derive not from Jewish sources, but from assimilated liberal sources, which are not necessarily the same thing as Jewish. If one wants to know what a Jewish concept is, he goes to a Jewish source. And it's quite true that to turn the other cheek is in the Bible. But you've been reading the wrong Bible. And one goes to the Jewish Bible for concepts of what a Jew does when there are no other ways. There was once a Jew named Moshe, Moses. He was a good Jew. By this time, he has already become an establishment Jew. And the Bible tells us of how Moses went out to his people, and he beheld an Egyptian smiting a Jew. Now Moses did not immediately rush to form a committee to study the root causes of Egyptian anti-Semitism. Vayach et ha-Mitzri, those are the words of the Bible, and he smote the Egyptian. We may like this, we may not like it, that's not relevant. That's a Jewish concept by a good Jew. Hanukkah comes, and we Jews light the candles. All Jews celebrate Hanukkah. It's not a difficult holiday to celebrate. And we take such immense pride in honoring the Maccabim, the Maccabees, those famous apostles of nonviolence. And we go to Israel. Masada, we climb Masada, and our hearts swell with pride as we think of those who fell there, the students of Gandhi. The point is that violence is a bad thing. It's always a bad thing. But sometimes it's necessary. And when the Talmud tells us that if one comes to slay you, slay him first, that is a Jewish concept. There is a time for war, and there is a time for peace. And for 53 years on the Soviet Jewish question, we tried the other ways. The nice ways. The Jewish ways. The respectable ways. We pleaded, we begged, we bribed, and above all, we waited. Jews have immense patience, especially when it is not they that are being persecuted. And we waited for all those years, and we did worse than nothing. What did we really do? If they were to open the gates of the Soviet Union tomorrow morning, and if they were to say all Jews may leave, how many Jews would leave? How many of the 3.5 million Jews would leave? Would 3 million leave? Would 2 million leave? Would 1 million leave? Every Jew that remains behind is our sin and our crime, because we gave the Soviet Union 50 years time to forcibly assimilate them. This is the product of our silence. This is the product of a policy which says, be careful what you do, you may make things worse. Worse? How much worse? They are letting Soviet Jews go now. They are letting them out by the hundreds. They're not asking them if they have relatives in Israel. They are letting out men of draft age. They are letting Jews out now. And they're letting them out for one reason: that Jews became militant, and Jews became angry, and Jews shouted slogans, "Two Russians for every Jew." And it's not just the militants, but if you suddenly see moderate groups beginning to have rallies and rallies for Soviet Jewry, you know why this is so, why all of a sudden they have begun to do these things. Because militancy always serves as a gadfly to the moderate and pushes the moderate into doing things which he would otherwise not do. It is important for us to understand that we have a possibility of very little time left in the Soviet Union. It's not merely a question of national and cultural genocide. There is a very distinct possibility. If not today, then tomorrow, or next year, or 2 years, of physical assaults upon Jews. Because this is what the Soviet Union would dearly love to do, but has not been able to, because it is a weak government. What does the Soviet Union hear when it watches 30,000 young Soviet Jews dancing outside the Moscow synagogue shouting, "Long live Israel"? What does the Kremlin hear? What does it see? It sees 30,000 Soviet citizens praising a fascist, aggressive state whose pilots shoot down Russian pilots, because Jewish pilots are better pilots than Russians. And what does the Soviet colonel at the Ovir office here, when a young Jew walks in and says, "I want to go live in Israel"? And the colonel asks him, why do you want to go to Israel? And the young Jew looks at him with mournful eyes and he says, because I have an uncle in Israel. And I cannot live unless I see my uncle. And this colonel knows that he has 12 uncles in Moscow. And he can very, very well live without seeing this other uncle. But that his real reason is, he wants to go to Israel, join the Israeli army, and in 6 months' time be fighting who? Be fighting him. So the Soviet Union would dearly love to do to its Jews what it would dearly love. But for the last 18 years since the death of Stalin, it has been weak. 18 precious years, 18 years of lost opportunities to do what we have been doing within the past year. They've been weak for 18 years, but who can say what tomorrow will bring? And who can say if tomorrow will not bring a repetition of 1953, the last year of Stalin, when he had lists drawn up of hundreds of thousands of Jews to be brought to the camps for a final solution. But God was good to us. How long will we have the opportunity that we have now? How much longer will we have? Coexistence with the West and desperately needing it. The Soviet Union has serious problems. One is called Chinese. 2.5 million Soviet troops are on the Chinese border. And this costs tens of billions of rubles. And rubles do not grow on trees. They are no different than dollars. There is another problem, dissent within the Soviet Union. Soviet citizens increasingly demand such filthy bourgeois objects as automobiles and television sets. And all these things also cost billions of rubles. And the Soviet Union is in great need of trade, in great need of dollars, in great need of cutting its costs. And how does it do all these things? And where does it get all these things? In the West. And this is why the Soviet Union does not know what to do when its buildings are blown up here, and when its diplomats are harassed, and when the wives of diplomats sit down with their Jewish dentist together with a New York Times man and bemoan the fact that they are psychological prisoners and that there is a reign of terror and that their children cannot play in Central Park. Jewish children cannot play in the pages of Jewish history in the Soviet Union. And Jewish children cannot play with their culture and with their faith and with their language. So Soviet children will not play in Central Park. When these things happen, what can the Soviet Union do? What it would like to do is take massive measures against America, but it cannot. Because it needs to build bridges with the West. It needs Western friendship, and we know it. And they know that we know it. So they allow Jews out now in the hope of buying us off cheaply. They won't. We have a golden opportunity. If we disrupt the foreign policy of the Soviet Union and of the United States, both of whom have the same policy. They want to build bridges to each other over the bodies of Soviet Jews and over the cries. This is called Munich. They want to buy peace at the expense of Jews. So it's our job to knock the bridges down. It's our job to create tensions and not to be afraid of doing this and not to be worried about maybe things will become worse for us. They won't be worse. Don't believe that the average non-Jew is unhappy, is as unhappy as Jews are when he reads about Soviets being given a difficult time. Quite the contrary. He sits and he watches on TV as a Soviet diplomat cries, "We are not safe here." And he laughs and he says, "It's about time." And the Soviet Union wants friendship with the West more than it wants to keep Jews prisoners. And if it is forced to pay a price for that friendship, it will pay the price, as it is paying it, in small coins. It will pay a heavier price if it has to. The Soviet Union is a very pragmatic government. But what has to be done is for Jews to understand that the beginnings come from us. If last week thousands of Jews went to Washington and sat on K and 16th Street, 30 years too late, but if they sat there and each one sat there and was led away, and the final total was not 800 but 1,347. 1,347 Jews demonstrating in Washington for what? For a Jewish cause. Amazing. And being arrested and defying the government and letting the president know that people that do this are indeed desperate people and capable of doing much, much more. This is what has to be done. Self-sacrifice and the readiness and the willingness of Jews, if necessary, to get arrested. If necessary, to challenge U.S. foreign policy. One does not conquer the top of the mountain unless there is a grave on the slope. And one does not achieve great things without a sacrifice. And this is what has to be known and understood by us. Resolutions alone will not save Soviet Jewry. By taking 750 Jewish leaders and making them fly thousands of miles at great public expense, Jewish public expense, and having them sit for 3 days and come up with an earth-shaking resolution, resolve that Jews of the Soviet Union shall go free, this will not save Soviet Jewry. How are we going to get them free? That is the question. How much are we ready to sacrifice? How much are we ready to do? How much are we ready to make life miserable for the Russians? How much are we willing to wreck their foreign policy and that which they need desperately? These are the questions. One final thing. There is a result which has taken place in the Soviet Jewish question which is often overlooked. More than the American Jew will save the Soviet Jew, it is clearly possible that the Soviet Jew will save the American Jew. Whether the Jewish Defense League will work miracles for Soviet Jewry or not, I don't know. But I do know that it has already worked miracles for American Jewish youth. Never at any time have so many alienated young Jews suddenly started to come back to something Jewish. And if those of you in this room would have been in Washington, you would have seen not just youngsters with yarmulkes, but youngsters that more properly you would have thought belonged to the SDS. And they were arrested for a Jewish cause. And they felt their Jewishness. And they marched off shouting, "Am Yisrael Chai," and "Never again." And once they were in those vans, and the vans were filled, they banged and said, "Bring more vans, bring more buses." And suddenly, Jewish youth has been turned on. Suddenly, there is something meaningful for them. And if you want to know why the Hillel buildings stand empty on the college campuses, and why the Jewish establishment groups don't have youngsters, and why temples and synagogues spend thousands and millions of dollars yearly on youth programs with a result which is worse than pathetic, and why JDL is able to get young people to sacrifice and to do incredible things, understand the difference. Understand that the young Jew does not want to be given things. He wants someone to come to him and say, "You give me. You give up something. You sacrifice for Jews, finally. It's about time that you march for a Jewish cause. It's about time that you got busted for Jews. You come to us and we guarantee it." We are in a struggle for the soul of the young Jew. And of course, it is a struggle for the future of Jews in this country. And we make a great mistake, a terrible error, if we believe that the young Jew does not want to be Jewish. We make a terrible error. He hungers for it and he thirsts for it. But how can we blame those Jews whose Jewish heroes on campus are Fidel and Che and Ho Ho Ho? How can we blame them? When did they ever hear of a Jewish freedom movement in which they should have pride? They know about a national liberation movement in Mozambique. They don't know of a Jewish national freedom movement known as the Irgun, or the Sternists, or the Haganah. They don't know this. And how should they know it? How should they know the name Dov Gruner? And how should they know that long before the Arabs awoke to a national consciousness, the Jewish freedom movement was fighting the colonialist, imperialist British? And Jewish freedom fighters died. And Dov Gruner, a member of the Irgun, was hanged. How should they know this? If they don't hear about it in their homes, and in their synagogues, and in their schools, from when shall they get Jewish pride when the typical education of the young Jew commences somewhere at the age of 10 or 11 or 12, when his mother brings him to a Hebrew school, a religious school, not, God forbid, for the purpose of making him Jewish, but so as to make some caterer rich and happy. And what more can we expect as this young Jew sits in his class, and perhaps he may be fortunate enough to listen to his rabbi or his teacher give him some pearls of Jewish wisdom. He may listen one day as his teacher tells him, "Yankala, there really are no more Jewish children named Yankala in America. Gordon, Gordon." You know that Jews don't eat bacon. This is a revelation to this little boy, who that very morning. Nevertheless, children are good, obedient, and they listen. And they go home. And they tell their parents, "You know, the rabbi told us that we can't have bacon tomorrow for breakfast." And thus begins the American Jewish way of death. His parents will take this young child, seat him and tell them, we're not sending you there for that. And they think that that settles the problem. And they think that this little child of 10 has been fooled. You don't fool children. You can't fool children. They're perceptive and they understand. And they instinctively perceive what is happening here, what a fraud this is, and what a sham this is. And this is the Judaism that this youngster carries with him from that day on. He plays the game for 2 more years or 3 more years because there is money to be made. But in the end, it is all over. All of it is over for this child. All of Judaism. And he seeks some other cause because that's an unbelievable need in young Jews to march for a cause, any cause. And if it's not Jewish, it will be non-Jewish. And if it's not non-Jewish, it will be anti-Jewish. But a cause. I'll march for anything. We have begun to give young Jews a cause. Young Jews are not upset at Jewish Defense League tactics. It's only the respectable Jew who will rise and say, I agree with your methods, with your aims. I think that they're wonderful, but I disagree with your tactics. That's what Jews tell us. As if we need to be given thanks for our aims. Who is there to argue with our aims? We want to free Soviet Jews. We're for Israel. We're for motherhood. The flag. So when people rise and they say, your aims are beautiful, you're not telling us anything. This which marks us as different from other groups are tactics. I much prefer the answer that Avi Hoffman gave me 2 months ago when I was on radio with him. And he said, well, I agree with your tactics, but I don't like your aims. Well, Abby can be saved because he has gone the more difficult way.